would have eliminated a corruption conviction against her brother, who himself led Thailand until his ouster in 2006. Anti-government protesters are seeking to replace the Thai government with an unelected so-called People's Council. At least 8 people have been killed and 22 wounded in a bombing today in Iraq. The attack comes one day after violence around Baghdad left at least 39 dead. Iraq is facing its worst violence since 2008, with over 6,300 people killed this year. In Venezuela, the government of President Nicolas Maduro has won a majority of victories in local elections nationwide. Maduro's coalition won 196 of the 337 mayoral races, although it lost in Venezuela's 2 largest cities. Maduro's opponent, Enrique Capriles, had billed the local races as a referendum on Maduro's government, but received just 42% of the overall vote, compared to Maduro's 49%. Maduro beat Capriles in presidential elections earlier this year, shortly after the death of Hugo Chavez. Venezuela's facing major economic challenges with high inflation, power cuts, and shortages of basic goods. Maduro has vowed to deepen a government campaign to force major retailers to cut prices on essential goods after accusing them of price fixing. The oil giant Chevron has suspended gas drilling in a Romanian village following local protests. Hundreds of people have been staging anti-fracking rallies near the Romanian town of Pungesti for several months, and clashes erupted with riot police last week. An 85-year-old veteran has returned to the United States after being freed by North Korea. Merrill Newman was detained for over a month after visiting North Korea as a tourist. The North Korean government accused him of war crimes for serving in the Korean War 60 years ago. Newman addressed reporters after arriving in San Francisco.
Good morning. I'm delighted to be home. I want to thank the Swedish embassy in Pyongyang and the American embassy in Beijing for all their help. It's been a great homecoming, and I'm tired, but ready to be with my family now. And thank you all for the support we got, and very much appreciated.
At least one other U.S. citizen is detained in North Korea, the Christian missionary Kenneth Bay, serving a 15-year sentence of hard labor for, quote, crimes against the state. And prosecutors in upstate New York have dropped charges against 3 black teenagers who were arrested for waiting for their school bus. The 3 were standing on a sidewalk where they were to be picked up and taken to their team's basketball game. When they refused a police order to disperse, they were arrested for disorderly conduct.
We tried to tell him that we was waiting for the bus, but we wasn't catching the city bus. We was catching the yellow bus. He didn't care. He arrested us anyways.
These young men were doing nothing wrong. Nothing wrong. They did exactly what they were supposed to do. And still, and yet, they get arrested.
After reviewing the case, the Monroe County District Attorney said she's dropping the charges. The Rochester Police Department has refused to apologize for the teen's arrest, saying that the arrests were justified. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
KBOO Community Radio and the North Portland Neighborhood Library is proud to sponsor the Jefferson High School 13th Annual Multicultural Film Festival. On December 10th, the film My So-Called Enemy is about 2 Palestinian and Israeli teenage girls who get to know their enemies as human beings while participating in a leadership program in the United States. That is December 10th at the North Portland Neighborhood Library off of Killingsworth Street at 6 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 19th year of the Portland Revels. The Portland Revels will perform 11 shows between December 6th and December 15th. That's the Portland Revels, December 6th to the 15th at the Scottish Rite Center in downtown Portland. More information about the show can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, business leaders present their 2014 priorities to local politicians.
Protesters in Pakistan and New York call for an end to U.S. drone strikes.
And we'll have an update on the impacts of cold weather on the Northwest. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, December 9th, 2013. I'm John Rasmussen.
And I'm Frances Fagan. Business interests and politicians attended the Oregon Leadership Summit at the Convention Center in Portland today. U.S. Senators Ron Wyden and Jeff Merkley gave an update of finances at the federal level. Governor Kitzhaber spoke in praise of the incentive system and called the Columbia River Crossing Bridge undead. KBOO's Joe Meyer attended the event and filed this report.
Local politicians flocked to the convention center today to interface with business leaders and to receive their policy playbook for 2014. The top three schemes for this 11th annual Love-In appeared to be build the bridge and more, connect education with careers, and unlock natural resources. Here's House Minority Leader Mike McLean explaining how to get things done.
If I was Speaker Pro Tem for a moment and I wanted to get the bridge done, I would make my best friend Cliff Benz from Ontario, and I would see if Cliff could work his magic yet again. And then second of all, I would make sure that Washington State was involved in producing a consensus structure. And if that means sitting down with the opposition in Washington and working through their objections and building a consensus bridge, then that's how I get the bridge done. Because ultimately, often I think the speaker has the task of trying to put together these packages of 31 votes without creating alienation that will then lead to rejection of other ideas just for the sake of being problematic. She is naturally inclined to do that by her personality, and so I would recommend to get your priorities done that you do make Cliff and then the opposition party in Washington a priority to listen to get the bridge done.
And here's House Speaker Tina Kotek.
When I was elected Speaker on opening day, I talked a lot about One Oregon. I really do believe that we are better as a whole if every community is succeeding and every community has what it needs to create jobs and support their communities. In terms of the timber industries and the natural resource discussion, I will have some staff, I believe, at the breakout today on natural resources and rural prosperity. I think that's a very important discussion. And I'm going to say right here now that I look forward to partnering with Senator Farioli on the idea of incentivizing. So, my office and my goal is to try to find common ground somewhere on every issue.
Finally, here's Governor Kitzhaber.
So here's where we are on the bridge. My biggest concern is that we decide by not deciding. I know that there are controversial aspects to this project and some legitimate issues that have been raised since Washington failed to make its appropriation. But let me start by saying this is not an Oregon goes it alone project. It is an Oregon-led bi-state project. The treasurer sent us a letter in September that said essentially that this Oregon-led bi-state effort is financially viable at current interest rates, even under the most pessimistic toll projections.
Now, that leads to one of the comments that people have made about our experience in Oregon with incentives and subsidies, and whether or not that's something that we've learned some lessons from, and what your plans are about that in the future.
Well, having just decided to agree with Intel, I plead guilty. I think that it would be nice if every state would disarm and that no one would compete for business, and I think that's unlikely. So I think the challenge is, how do you develop incentives that are highly targeted to the industry you're trying to help and don't sell the farm? I think with the tapering off of the BSIC, which was a real problem, we have an opportunity to rethink, I think, our whole set of incentives here in the state of Oregon. And I think that should be one of the things on the agenda of the Oregon Business Plan going forward.
Business leaders laid out their priorities today at the Oregon Convention Center. Politicians led by Governor Kitzhaber and House Speaker Tina Kotek seemed more than willing to play ball on their top initiative, the Columbia River Crossing. And I'm Joe Meyer with KBOO News.
Record-breaking cold weather descended on the Northwest late last week and intensified over the weekend. Many cities across the state set record lows by Sunday night, and temperatures aren't expected to rise above 40 degrees until Wednesday, according to current forecasts. KBOO reporter Ross Freeman-Levin spoke with Steve Pierce of the Oregon chapter of the American Meteorological Society for more details on the current cold weather patterns.
I was hoping that you could describe the current weather pattern that we're in and how that stacks up with the historical record, and maybe also describe what people have to look forward to in the coming day or two.
First off, for starters, we had a very cold Arctic air mass, very dry air mass, spread down over the entire Pacific Northwest late last week. And then we had a disturbance off of the British Columbia coast, slid down and set up shop right about Astoria, just off the coast. And as most folks know, that spread snow across an interesting area in the Portland metro area. Only Clark County and Vancouver seemed to get snow in the Portland metro area. And then across the Columbia River in Columbia County over in Scappoose, they got a fairly good amount of snow, but nothing necessarily in the Portland metro area or southward until you get to just south of Salem. From about Albany, Corvallis southward, they got heavy snow. Upwards of 10 inches of snow fell in and around the Eugene area, and a good 4 to 6 inches from Eugene all the way down to the California border near Ashland. Now, that set the stage for additional cold air that came pouring out of the Columbia River Gorge Friday night into Saturday, along with clearing skies. Once we had that snow cover on the ground, that gave us a blanket, and that does two things. One, it traps any heat, latent heat source, which of course is the earth or buildings. It keeps that heat from rising up, and it also allows what's called radiational cooling to accelerate, where when you've got snow cover and clear skies, you can radiate any heat that's on the surface of the earth out very quickly. So it acts as a dual insulator, and then it also helps the snow to radiate any heat that's above the snow or above the ground out into space. And that was exactly what took place in the southern Willamette Valley on Saturday and statewide, for that matter, on Sunday. I expect most locations, Portland, Salem, Eugene, will likely crack freezing tomorrow and then be into the upper 30s, near 40 then on Wednesday and Thursday. And that should bring an end to the entire situation. There is a chance that in the Columbia River Gorge, of course, there'll still be substantial amount of cold air pooled there, and we could start out as snow or freezing rain tomorrow in the gorge, deep in the gorge. So it could be a tricky transition or a messy transition there. But slowly but surely, almost a week later, we will crawl ourselves out of this. And already gearing up to do so along the coast. There are several locations of crack 32 there. And as soon as we do pass 32 degrees, especially for folks down in Eugene, we're talking about frozen pipes. It's going to be a major issue. I would say the emphasis is going to shift now in the next 48 hours into burst pipe repair all across the Pacific Northwest. And that is something that will be on a lot of homeowners' minds as we start to warm things up.
Is there a good venue for people to track the coming weather systems to prepare for these events and the potential impacts that they'll have on their daily lives?
The Portland Office of the National Weather Service. Just use your favorite search engine on the internet and look up Portland National Weather Service. You'll see the link to their website. And if you're in the Medford area, the Medford National Weather Service, and then on the east side, the Pendleton National Weather Service. And Portland covers everything up into Southwest Washington. So between those three websites, depending on where your viewing audience or listening audience is, that's the best, the official source for weather forecast that most of the area uses is the National Weather Service, the NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. It's a great resource that folks can look up historical data and get latest weather forecasts, and they go out several days, and they've got a great website. I highly recommend folks go check it out.
Thank you again for your time today. I've been speaking with Steve Pierce, owner of the Northwest Weather Consultants and president of the Oregon chapter of the American Meteorological Society. Thank you, Steve, for your time today.
You bet. Thank you.
Prisoners at the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility in Wilsonville are not immune to the current freezing weather. Prison officials ordered 70 portable toilets today after their sewer system froze and became unusable. The frozen plumbing has left the more than 1,700 inmates at the prison without functioning toilets. Inmates are now using portable outdoor toilets during the current cold weather. Visits to inmates were canceled today, and estimates from prison officials indicate that the required plumbing repairs could take a day or more.
Several organizations that provide emergency services to Portland's homeless are seeing such a jump in demand for cold weather gear that it may exceed their capacity to deliver. As a result, groups like Street Roots and Human Solutions have issued a request for donations of hats, coats, blankets, and thermal underwear, while others are asking for food and hygiene items. If you can help, please visit our website at kboo.org for a list of these organizations, as well as information on when and where you can deliver your donations.
The Seattle City Council today unanimously approved a resolution supporting federal comprehensive immigration reform. Unlike similar resolutions adopted across the country, the Seattle resolution includes specific language stating that the needs of lesbians, gays, bisexuals, transgendered, disabled, and women should also be addressed by federal immigration reform bills. The Seattle City Council has urged other cities around the country to pass similar resolutions supporting immigrant rights. The Seattle resolution establishes policy priorities in support of federal comprehensive immigration reform. These include an accessible roadmap to citizenship for all individuals living in the United States, family reunification, and policies providing dignity to immigrants in employment and in court.
Today, the U.S. Justice Department charged 18 current and former Los Angeles deputies for civil rights violations and obstruction in connection with an investigation the FBI began in 2011. Charges outlined for the Los Angeles deputies include four indictments and a criminal complaint, contending that inmates and visitors at area jails were beaten, as well as a conspiracy to obstruct a misconduct investigation. The majority of arrested deputies remain in custody, as arraignments are scheduled for this evening.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview by Jimmy Tardy with representatives from Portland Jobs with Justice on the upcoming Scrooge of the Year party. That's followed by Labor Radio at 7, where we'll get an update on the situation in Honduras, where protesters continue to challenge the results of the recent presidential elections, alleging widespread fraud by the ruling party. Prison Pipeline starts at 6:30. Tonight's show focuses on re-entry programs for Multnomah County inmates. Former prisoners are often released with little or no assets, limited ties to the community, and lack of awareness of services and programs available to help. But some local groups are hoping to change that and make it easier for former prisoners to be able to re-enter society. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is forecast to be cold, with high temperatures reaching 36 degrees and a 70% chance of snowfall. Tonight's temperatures will drop into the mid-20s with a 30% chance of snow. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are 33 counts per minute in North Portland with a high of 59. In Raleigh Hills, it's 30 cpm with a high of 49. Powell Butte measures 25 cpm with a high of 42. Seaside, Oregon has 33 CPM, high of 55, and Sitka, Alaska has a radiation count of 33 counts per minute with spikes up to 52. EPA alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information can be found at radcast.org.
The time is 5:21. We go now to our scheduled daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Timmy Geithner has landed. The Secretary of the Treasury in President Obama's first term resigned early this year, and we lost track of him for months. But in November, Geithner reappeared, having spun himself through Washington's revolving door, whoosh, 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 and flung himself all the way up to Wall Street, landing softly in the cushy quarters of Warburg Pincus, one of America's top 10 private equity empires. Yes, the guy who was responsible for rescuing and regulating Wall Street's too-big-to-fail multi-billion-dollar financial casinos is now president of one. Writing in the New Yorker magazine, Andrew Huszar says we need not be surprised that the former Treasury chief is cashing in on his insider knowledge and contacts. Huszar worked at the New York Federal Reserve Bank when Geithner became president of that powerful supervisor of Wall Street firms. He says that rather than promoting knowledgeable regulators from within the Fed, Geithner broke with tradition and prudence to put top bankers from J.P. Morgan Chase, American Express, Goldman Sachs, and other powerhouse firms in key regulatory positions. In other words, the new honcho built his own revolving door in the New York Fed, bringing in bankers to regulate themselves. Thus, when Obama promoted Geithner to head the Treasury Department, Huszar was again unsurprised that our nation's overseer of banksters quickly proved to be their comforter and protector. Geithner never publicly advocated for the truly forceful and clean revamp of Wall Street, writes Huszar. Instead, using his influence to convince Obama and other lawmakers to be more accommodating to the big banks. This is Jim Hightower saying, whether spinning from the inside out or from the outside in, Geithner's proof that the Washington Wall Street revolving door serves bankers, not the public interest. We need to weld it shut.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Actions in 30 U.S. cities on Monday highlighted awareness about public education issues and needs. The Chicago Teachers Union's Jackson Potter says these are the specifics needed in Chicago for strong public education.
We're asking for democracy, an elected representative school board. We're the only big city in the state without one. It's appointed by the mayor. We're asking for stable and vibrant families, so that means raising the minimum wage. It means universal pre-K. We're asking to support schools so that they can succeed, and that means fair funding and a fair tax so that the wealthy pay their fair share. And it also means moratorium on charter proliferation, which have been slowly eroding the ability for neighborhood schools to function.
This is International Human Rights Day, and a diverse group in New York City is marking the day with civil disobedience in front of the immigration court to demand reform of the immigration system. That action is being led by undocumented youth to highlight the system that tears apart 1,100 families a day through deportations. Groups from four states are also gathering in New York City today to mark International Human Rights Day by celebrating the first state in the union to implement America's first universal publicly financed health care system. Vermont's Health Care is a Human Right campaign got it passed in 2011. It committed Vermont to provide as a public good comprehensive, affordable, high-quality, publicly financed health care coverage for all Vermont residents. The Wisconsin Fair Trade Coalition joined the Wisconsin AFL CIO, Environmental and Family Farm Representatives Monday to call on U.S. Representative Ron Kind to vote no on fast-track authority for the trade bill known as TPP. Bill Brockmiller is president of the Western Wisconsin AFL-CIO.
The TPP itself is bad for working families, it's bad for environmental groups, it's bad for family farms.
And Brockmiller says no matter what's actually in the Trans Trans-Pacific Partnership trade bill, Fast Track Authority guts democracy as Congress considers whether or not to pass it. The former CEO of Republic Windows and Doors in Chicago will be starting a 4-year prison sentence for the holidays. Richard Gilman pleaded guilty to one count of theft for looting Republic Windows and Doors. He was fined $100,000. More than 200 workers sat in for 6 days demanding vacation and severance pay owed them when the factory abruptly closed in 2008. They won that sit-down strike. Gilman stole at least $500,000 from the business by his own admission. Workers who attended Gilman's court hearing were ecstatic to see him convicted. Gilman apologized to the workers in the courtroom as he was sentenced.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned and represented Bank of Labor, member FDIC, equal opportunity lender. Bank of Labor offers a business Visa card with no annual fee and points earned with every purchase, as well as rental vehicle and travel accident insurance. More info online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Once the domain of federal agencies, cell phone surveillance is now widely used by local police agencies, often with little oversight. Cell phone companies are even profiting from this practice, with some carriers charging the police agencies a surveillance fee. A recent congressional inquiry revealed that agencies from the FBI to local police have been routinely performing what is described as massive amounts of surveillance to American phone calls, often without probable cause warrants. Carriers such as T-Mobile, AT&T, Sprint, Verizon, as well as smaller carriers like Cricket, received over 1.1 million requests for customer data last year. These companies have made a profit of tens of millions of dollars from fees they charge to release their consumers' personal information. Authorities are able to acquire private data from thousands of customers at once by using what is called a cell tower dump. This process takes the signature of a judge and is reportedly based on assurance that the information is relevant to an investigation. These dumps release data from anyone using a cell phone within range of the tower, including text information, records of websites visited, and voicemail. The recent information comes amid revelations that the National Security Agency has been collecting upwards of 5 billion records daily of cell phone activities around the globe, often without warrants. Today, in reaction to this news, Senator Edward Markey of Massachusetts stated he would introduce legislation that would require a probable cause warrant for cell phone tracking. The American Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit against the Obama administration earlier this year for these surveillance rights, calling it a dragnet practice and a violation to civil rights.
With talks wrapping up on negotiations for the Trans-Pacific Partnership underway this week in Singapore, WikiLeaks published a pair of documents which illustrate that many countries involved need more convincing before signing on. The documents include a nation-by-nation list which show that disagreements remain after the November gathering of negotiators in Salt Lake City, Utah. Other material suggests that if the Asia-Pacific countries won't back down regarding differences on a total of 14 different chapters of the draft agreement, that the treaty might fail in its entirety.
This afternoon, two Yale Divinity School students and a Catholic worker were arrested for protesting drone strikes at the Hancock Air Base in Syracuse, New York. Today's protest comes in the wake of ongoing rallies at the Afghan-Pakistan border that began last week and have so far managed to block the transport of U.S. drone equipment into Pakistan. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg has more.
The protesters arrested in New York today were trying to deliver an order of protection on behalf of Afghan children and their families who have been the victims of U.S. drone strikes that originated from the Hancock Air Base. Since October 2012, over 50 people have been arrested and issued orders of protection for protesting the killing of children by Reaper drones piloted from Hancock Air Base. The local DeWitt Town Court has issued the orders at the request of military officers at Hancock Air Base. Activist Kathy Kelly points out the somewhat ridiculous nature of these so-called protection orders.
The head of the Air National Guard base has now put out an order of protection saying that the demonstrators are a threat to him personally, which is a strange idea. You know, he's on a highly militarized base, and he's afraid of 75-year-old grandmothers who are standing outside with signs that say, you know, stop the drone warfare. So people are constantly going to trial. Those trials have been strung out over a long period of time, and it's a very, very interesting process. Brian Terrell just completed a six-month sentence for going to Whiteman Air Force Base outside of Kansas City, Missouri, and entering the base with a letter about international law and drone warfare. And that was after a weekend of study and a fairly large demonstration outside the base. And Brian is a co-coordinator for Voices, and so people could get in touch with him just by writing to info@vcnv.org. He's available to speak, and he's doing so very widely.
The protesters' main grievance is that Hancock's 174th Attack Wing technicians pilot weaponized Reaper drones over Afghanistan. These drones are engaged in the targeted killing of civilians. In this critique, they are joined by Afghan and Pakistani civilians, many of whom have taken part in a week-long blockade at the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan that has so far managed to stop the shipment of U.S.-made weaponized drones into Pakistan. I spoke with Kathy Kelly, the head of the peace group Voices for Creative Nonviolence, about the significance of this ongoing protest in Waziristan.
Well, I think that people in Pakistan believe that their government should, as a sovereign country, have a right to demand that civilians in Pakistan, you know, Pakistan's supposed to be an ally of the United States, be protected from drone attacks, particularly in the area of North and South Waziristan, but even on one occasion outside of that tribal area. And so if the government is not taking vigorous and strong stands to protect people from the drone strikes, I think it's not so surprising that people would gather together and say, well, we'll take a stand. And, of course, Pakistan has been very vital for the shipping in and out of materials that have been used for supporting the United States' lengthy occupation in Afghanistan. And if those trucks, the NATO supply trucks, whether they're going out of the country or coming in, can't cross at the borders, then they have to go on a very, very expensive and lengthy trek, and it costs a great deal of money, and it's actually quite dangerous in this weather for drivers to go all the way up into the northern stans, basically, and then come down someplace called the Salang Pass and then try to fan out and make deliveries or try to truck goods out of Afghanistan, but it will cost an enormous sum of money. It was $1 million per soldier per year up until the drawdown began in terms of how much it costs to maintain one soldier from the United States in Afghanistan. They had to boost that up to $2.1 million per soldier per year because of the added expenses of what one lieutenant colonel called the largest retrograde mission in history. So I think the people in Pakistan who've organized this kind of protest know that they have some considerable leverage. I think it's a good time for education, but also people do well to be, taking signs, going out to these various bases, calling their congresspeople, finding out, does this make of our area, our community, a war zone because of the imminence of a threat? You know, there are, with the proliferation of drones being made all over the world, what if other people said, look, if you can do this to us, why wouldn't we have the right to retaliate? I don't encourage retaliation and revenge ever, but I think we have to think about these realities of the world we're moving into.
And if people are interested here locally, there is a drone manufacturer in Hood River known as In Situ. In fact, the drone that was captured by Iran last year was manufactured there at In Situ, a company located at Hood River. Senator Wyden most recently made the statement that defended the assassination of Anwar al-Awlaki, a U.S. citizen, by a drone strike. He is a U.S. senator from Oregon and made that finding just last week. That's Senator Ron Wyden. And if people want to get in touch with the work that Kathy Kelly is doing with the Voices for Creative Nonviolence, that website, vcnv.org. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, December 9th, 2013. Israeli troops kidnap four civilians during morning invasions and uproot olive trees to expand a road for settlers. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Palestinian sources reported that Israeli military bulldozers uprooted on Monday more than 40 olive trees in order to connect Settlers Road No. 60 with the Kremazan Monastery in Beit Jala town, west of Bethlehem, southern West Bank and other areas. Orchard owners stated that the army previously uprooted 15 trees in their orchard in order to expand the road and came back today to uproot 40 more olive trees. Road constructions and expansions is leading to massive illegal confiscation of Palestinian lands in occupied East Jerusalem, including Beit Safafa town and in Bethlehem. Israel also intends to build a national garden in the area. Furthermore, also on Monday, soldiers completely isolated 12 Palestinian villages near Yatta town, south of the southern West Bank city of Hebron. Coordinator of the Popular Committee Against the Wall and Settlements in Yatta town said that the soldiers blazed concrete blocks, sealing the main road, linking Yatta with the eastern communities. Soldiers also declared the area a closed military zone, stopped and searched dozens of residents and vehicles, and forced them back. Earlier on Monday at dawn, dozens of Israeli soldiers invaded the northern West Bank city of Jenin and Jenin refugee camp and kidnapped four Palestinians. A fifth Palestinian was kidnapped at a roadblock near Jenin city. In other news, the Palestinian Political Detainees Society held by the Israeli army announced on Monday that prisoner Naeem Shoamra is now unable to move and is facing death. Shoamra was moved from the Israeli army detention camp of Ascalon 4 days ago to an Israeli military hospital where he was diagnosed with ALS. The Palestinian Political Detainees Society demanded his immediate release so he can be properly treated before it's too late. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, December 9th, 2013 News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
After the death of South African leader Nelson Mandela on Thursday, memorials have taken place around the world. Locally, a memorial is planned for tomorrow, Tuesday, December 10th, at 6:30 p.m. at the Maranatha Church on 4222 Northeast 12th Avenue in Portland. It's sponsored by the Albina Ministerial Alliance Coalition for Justice and Police Reform and the Center for Intercultural Organizing. Over the past few days, political leaders around the world have voiced eulogies, remembering Mandela's life of devotion to the cause of South African liberation. Somewhat lost in the mix, however, have been Mandela's steadfast support for armed struggle and the liberation of oppressed people around the world. In recent years, Nelson Mandela stated on a number of occasions that the Palestinian people are suffering under a similar racism that the black South Africans faced under apartheid. At a hearing in the United Nations several years ago, Mandela stated that the world will not be free until the Palestinian people are free. The official memorial for Nelson Mandela will be held this coming weekend, and 70 world leaders plan to be in attendance, including U.S. President Barack Obama. Conspicuously absent from the memorial will be Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Among those criticizing the way Mandela is being eulogized in the world media is U.S. political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal. He issued the following statement today from his prison cell in Pennsylvania.
Mandela, sanitized. He was born Holy Shlashla in July of 1918, in a nation of which he was not truly a citizen. into a country called the Union of South Africa, a part of the British Empire. The world would come to know him as Nelson, a name given him by a grade school teacher, Nelson Mandela. At long last, after 95 years of life, Mandela has returned to his ancestors. Mandela, between birth and death, has blazed an amazing life of love and revolution, of struggle and resistance, of prison and isolation, of freedom, and now death. At his passing, American media has painted him as a kind of African civil rights leader, perhaps Martin Luther King IV, with a halo of white hair. An American president issued a statement lamenting his wrongful imprisonment. In fact, it is dangerously misleading to make of Mandela a king or a Malcolm. He was neither. He was himself an African, a lawyer who used every tool available to him, legal when he could, illegal when he must, to resist a system that crushed African lives like peanut shells. He was, too, a revolutionary, an armed guerrilla, and commander of a guerrilla army. Umkhonto weSizwe, or Spear of the Nation of the African National Congress. The South African government, after 1948, became an instrument of the terror and torture that only a paranoid people like the South African Boers could muster. Under the banner of the National Party, the government erected the odious barrier of apartheid, Afrikaans for apartness, which took white supremacy and black subordination to truly insane and dehumanizing levels. South Africa became the embodiment of legalized white racism and blindingly brutal oppression, designed principally to extract and exploit black labor at the cheapest price. At every opportunity, it strove to sow humiliation, pain, and violence in African lives. It corrupted every facet of African life, economy, education, health, jobs, family, to white ends. Dr. Nelson Mandela was hired to consolidate this state of affairs, and today South Africa is one of the most economically unequal nations on earth, exceeded perhaps only by that of the United States. A child born to the royal house of an African tribe, in a land claimed by the British Empire, in a nation where race and complexion entitle one to privilege or oppression, opened the door to a new nation by leaving the political prison house to enter the presidency. This is the stuff of high drama, of dreams made real, of epic losses, of aching loneliness, of doing the right thing at the right time. Apartheid may be gone, but privilege ain't. For millions of South Africans, the long walk to freedom still ain't over. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, a drone strike in eastern Kunar province of Afghanistan killed at least 4 alleged Taliban militants over the weekend. Local security officials confirmed the militants were killed in the Asmar district late Saturday. The U.S. Defense Department has announced it plans to buy helicopters for the Afghan military, but not from U.S. companies. The Pentagon will spend more than $1 billion on the Russian-built Mi-17 helicopters for Afghan security forces. The Washington Post has reported that building the so-called Afghan Pentagon in Kabul has cost double the initial estimates. The American government has already spent about $107 million on the 5-story Defense Ministry headquarters. A British Royal Marine convicted of murdering a wounded Taliban insurgent was sentenced last Friday to a minimum of 10 years in prison. 2 other Marines were acquitted of the September 2011 killing in Afghanistan's southern Helmand province. The Marines were charged after military authorities found footage of the incident on a helmet camera belonging to one of the men. You are listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032.
Our production team for tonight's newscast is Robin Ryan and Joe Meyer. The producer is Ross Freeman-Levin, with special thanks to reporter Jimmy Tardy. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. And the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm John Rasmussen.
And I'm Frances Fagan. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodwin and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, the host interviews filmmaker and former Portlander Penny Allen about European and North African politics in her latest film, Late to My Mother's Funeral. At 9, Alternative Radio features a talk by former Central Intelligence Agency operative Ray McGovern on whistleblowers. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre.
At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on stage and studio, host D-May Roberts focuses on two local holiday plays, Artist Repertory Theater's Christmas Unplugged, directed by Luann Moldovan and Rusty Tennant, and Triangle Productions' American Fiesta, directed by Donald Horn. At 11:30 on Art Focus, Joseph Gallivan interviews conceptual artist Ben Buswell about his process-driven photography and sculpture.
Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support for community radio. If you are not a member, you can become one now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
We go now to an interview conducted by KBOO reporter Jimmy Tardy. Good night, Frances.
Good night, John.
I'm here with Marco Mejia and Laura Bolaños. They are with Portland Jobs with Justice, and we're here today to talk about the 2013 Scrooge of the Year party. Welcome to both of you.
Oh, thank you very much.
I'm glad to have you here. So the Scrooge of the Year party is going to be this Saturday, December 14th at 7 p.m. at the Peace House. That's at 2116 Northeast 18th Avenue. Scrooge of the Year Awards. It's a prestigious award given by Portland Jobs with Justice to the Scrooge of the Year, which is an honor that you have to earn in a couple of ways. For one, you have to qualify as being Scrooge-like, and you also have to win the vote, which will happen this Saturday at the Peace House. Is that correct?
Oh, it is. Marco? And I will say is that this honor award.
A dishonor, yes, yes, exactly.
It's a big one, yes.
This has been an ongoing project of Portland Jobs with Justice.
Yeah, it has been there for several years already, and it came up actually as an idea of dishonoring the people or the institutions that have been really bad, you know, affecting workers and their livelihoods and doing really, you know, bad stuff to workers or to the community.
The nominees for this year are Erica Brix, who is the Portland District Supervisor for the U.S. Postal Service, Yvonne Deckard, who is a consultant for the Portland Public School District, Coin TV, the Portland Business Alliance, and our very own Multnomah County Sheriff Don Statton.
That's right.
So give me a little bit of an insight into each of these characters and why they qualify in the final round of this year's Scrooge of the Year award.
We have Erica Brix, you know. Many people probably have heard about the closings of a lot of postal offices and processing plants, and also to close the Saturday and even more of delivery for the postal service. So Erica Brix is the local manager of the postal service here. And I understand that she has been denied line about 7 times to meet with the postal workers and talk and dialogue about this and what's going on in this community and what's going to happen. So that's why she represents the local postal office and also the overall postal office that is trying to cut more than 200,000 jobs nationwide, even though many of the ones that are proposing to do the cuts are the ones that say that we need jobs. But they want to cut the jobs, and what they want to do is give it up to the private companies. So that's why we have Erica Briggs representing that sector.
Yeah, they want to privatize the workforce and sell the postal properties. Senator Dianne Feinstein, you know who we're talking about. You know what we're talking about. But that's for another conversation. Why don't you continue with the list?
Yeah, so then we have going down just the list, Yvonne Decker. She is a nice lady, of course, but, you know, she has been working for the other side of the justice, if you want it, from the perspective of the education system and the teachers.
Yeah, so $15,000 a month a consultant.
Oh,
$15,000 a month.
There is no money to do other things and to pay the teachers, but there is money to pay a consultant that is trying to help how to privatize and how to take the Portland Public School to a different level, and not the good level, but actually the testing and give to companies and supporting charter schools that, you know, they work by themselves and then they need to get their own funding, etc., etc., etc. What they want to do is get rid of the union and follow the corporate model in this country, and that's not right. So anyway, that other one is the Coin TV. You know, our local Coin TV, what they're doing is exactly the same as the other ones, trying to give it up to, well, not give it up. They are already part of the corporate world, but actually to use the model of having a very unstable job for everyone, get rid of the union. They have not been negotiating and with the union in good faith. And what they have been doing is actually cutting some jobs of some people that have, here locally in the Coin TV. And saying that they can do this job everywhere, anywhere that they want. So they're taking jobs to other places where, in that way, they're just going to make it weak, the union. And by the way, for many people that, you know, a lot of people know how important the union is, you know, in terms of defending your job and a little bit of security for your job. What they want to do is have people that are vulnerable, workers that cannot say anything and that they can just handle the way they want it. That's pretty much what's happening. And they fired already a number of workers at Coin TV, and they are fighting it so that they respect and see if they can get back their jobs, but if not, also, you know, fighting for the rights of the other workers at Coin TV.
And Coin, of course, likes to represent itself as a local media, local television, but I understand that you were telling me they're outsourcing their jobs to
exactly.
other parts of the country. So the editing and some of the technical production aspects that really truly can be done anywhere. The point is that the income generated by Coin TV, that they're sending the work and therefore the money out of the area. So is this a local television station or not?
Exactly. At the end, the local stuff is just a cliche that they use for getting in and say that they're local. But at the end, what they're doing is what is more convenient to make more money and their profits. And if it is cutting jobs locally and taking it away, that's what they're doing now. So the next one is the Portland Business Alliance, and many people know that. It's kind of a nice name. So we have, you know, a relationship that was made. The Climate Jobs Committee, that's called like that, here in Portland, which is working on environmental issues and labor and jobs, they proposed them because they are actually the organization that is not a friend of labor and, of course, not respecting also the environment, because what they do in their business don't care about the environment and jobs, as we've been kind of going through the list, right? They care more about the profits. And if they can maximize, you know, the profit, that's what's good for them. And regardless, you know, if it's affecting lives, real lives of workers, local workers, and anywhere in the world. So The Portland Business Alliance is going to be that one, the candidate. And what we want to do there is make the connection that there's this myth that, you know, the environment doesn't connect with labor issues. And actually, they are connected, you know. And more, I think that workers and everyone else is understanding, you know, how important the environment is to everyone else and try to show that. So anyway, they are the other candidates, you know, for working on, you know, in what they represent, you know, the business community that especially don't care much about the environment and, you know.
Profits and, above all else.
Exactly. That's what it is. And we have the last one candidate. It's, as you said, our own local sheriff in the county, the Multnomah County, is the Sheriff Staten. Many people will know so far that how our communities have been made more insecure. We had in the county a collaboration between ICE, the police, the immigration police, with the local police. What's happening in there is that it's kind of like when ICE come in, it's like making people think that there's not a local justice system, that they need to impose something else to handle things and really, you know, process some of the people that are undocumented. That usually the people that come and are booked into the jail, the jail share the information with ICE, with the immigration police, and many of them come for felonies or for nothing almost, right? Usually their charges are dropped, but then the ICE comes and places a hold, what's called the ICE hold, on them, and then they end up being detained in the private owned detention center in Tacoma, and then probably deported at the end. And that what it's doing is that it's separating our families. It is creating an insecure community where people, not just undocumented immigrants, not just immigrants, but the whole community feels very affected by it, that they cannot call the police to report crimes because it might be that actually the victims are going to be the ones that are going to be, you know, detained and deported, because that has been happening already. So the Sheriff Staten, he thinks that ICE holds should be honored for ICE, you know, and it's not. That's not the truth. We know around the country, a lot of cities and counties are changing their policy, saying, no, we don't want that because that's really destroying the trust in the police and the trust in our local system, the justice system, and they say no to that. Already a number of those throughout the country. But Sheriff Staten said, oh, no, I need to respect the law, which is not a law. It's a lot of different things in how they handle things. But at the end, he changed his mind and went halfway. He said, okay, I'm not going to honor ICE holds on nonviolent crimes. The 2 days later that we had, you know, a reaffirming of that policy that he did, there was a young person detained that had a charge that wasn't for a ICE hold. But then the sheriff came up and said, oh, you know what? Actually, I'm sorry. I forgot to tell you. I decided that we're going to have this kind of, you know, felony, you know, to be placed an ICE hold on it. So he changed, so we cannot trust, you know, in terms of him, in terms of his own policy, he's violating that and violating already the relationship that we have been developing with the community.
Apparently what is happening is that he's starting to expand the charges that he'll use in order to honor an ICE hold, which is what is ICE?
ICE is Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
Immigration and Customs Enforcement. It's worth saying that any violent crime against anyone in our community is a threat to all of the community, in that the perpetrator of such a crime, if they can get away with it because somebody doesn't report them, because they're afraid that they're going to go into jail
exactly, for
reporting a violent crime, and then that person who's committed that crime is therefore more likely to go and do it again, and we're not addressing the real concerns of people, which is violent crime. which should stay at the top of everybody's list, and instead it gets shifted to issues of immigration and residency.
Exactly. And one thing is that, you know, the sheriff, they say that they are champions of, you know, like domestic violence victims. Actually, what's happening right now is that more and more, especially domestic violence victims are not reporting at all now any kind of crime that happened to them, because they know it, that if they report it, you know, their partner that is involved in it or themselves will be going through the process and might get deported. So it's a very difficult situation. We have a justice system that addresses that already.
Local system.
Yeah, that we don't need anything else. Actually, what's happening now when we put and bring ICE into the picture, that's what is destroying the trust of the police and the system.
Right.
And it's not going in a good direction, that, because, you know, how in reality happens is that the immigrant community is not them and somebody else that live outside of this community and another community.
Right.
No, the immigrant community is part of the overall community. So it affects us all.
We've been talking about the Scrooge of the Year party, which is Portland Jobs with Justice. It's an annual fundraiser. It's going to be happening Saturday, December 14th at 7 p.m. at the Peace House, which is located at 2116 Northeast 18th Avenue. Tickets are $15. You get 15 votes with your ticket, and you can also buy more votes, because this vote is for sale.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that, because that's a part of actually of the fun of this thing, because what we're trying to use here is to use our own system, electoral system and democratic system, which is the vote, right? But as we, many of us know, how it really works at the end is that a lot of the votes are being purchased. You know, they're for sale. You know, corporations are considered persons, by the way, right nowadays. So all of them put so much money to get the candidate that they want, right? And they do it. They get it. So what we're doing here is that same thing, same process. You come and you buy the vote. You can get your candidate to win if you buy enough votes that you want. So this is a party, right? That's the idea, that we don't want to get. I mean, we've been talking about all of these bad things, all these people. But at the end, I think it's a way of saying, hey, let's have some fun too around this. We get together. There's food. It's actually, you know, with your ticket, you come in. There's food. You can get for a donation. You can get a drink. We're gonna have wine, soft drinks, beer, and also we're gonna have. Oh, also there's gonna be some skits. You know, some role play, because all these